Now, where and when were you born?
I was born in Sydenham, London, England, Kent, on the 5th of September, 1892.
And what was your father's occupation?
My father's occupation was teamster, I would put him.
Was what company?
Well, he was with a cartage company.
And at what age did you come to Canada?
20.
And,
yeah, I was 20 years old. Mm-hmm.
And you came over by boat, did you?
Came over on the Ascania, mm-hmm. from Liverpool to Quebec. From Quebec to Winnipeg.
And you came on the train, did you?
I'm on the train, on CPR, yes.
What was the train trip like from Quebec to Winnipeg?
Well, it was very good. We came tourist, of course, cheap rate. But we were allowed to have, they give us mattresses to sleep on those days.
Were there many immigrants on the train?
Oh, yes. Yes, there was an awful lot from London at that time. I would say, coming across on the boat, coming from all parts, there'd be about 300 or 400 at least, from all parts of England, you know.
And what was Winnipeg like when you arrived? Was it a big city or just a little town? Or?
No, it seemed to me, always thought that Western Canada was more all prairie. I mean, that was how we visualized it when we left home. And but I was, to my surprise, to arrive in the CPR station to find what a big station it was, even compared with mine at home where I lived, you know. As far as Winnipeg is concerned, comparing it with today, there's no comparison. So many places that were there then are not there now. But it wasn't such a, you know, it wasn't such a far back town as I thought it might be.
Where did you first stay when you arrived?
When I came into Winnipeg, I had a brother living here. And I stayed with him on Selkirk Avenue until I got a room for myself, you see. I landed here on Wednesday. He came to meet me, of course. And he said, if you want to go to work, I have can get you a job. So I went down on the Thursday to see the Winnipeg School Board, and they told me that I had a job and I could start to work tomorrow if I wanted to. So I went to work for the school board. That was in October 1912. And I stayed with the Winnipeg School Board, apart from going overseas in the First War, back again, back to work, and again overseas in the Second War. So my service with the school board continually, including that, was 42 years.
And what was your occupation with the school board?
I was a janitor.
And what school was this at? Were you at various schools?
No, I'd done 37 years at the principal's violin school here. I first started for a year at the Wellington School as an assistant caretaker. Back in that time, the wages was, at that time, $60 a month. To be a head caretaker, you could go up to 80, but it took you 4 years to get it, $5 raise a year to 80. So I worked at the principal's violin for 37 years after coming back from the Second World War, and the Sergeant Park School was opened as a new school. And I asked for a transfer there, and I went there until I retired at the Sergeant Park School.
And what year did you retire in?
In 1954.
Let's go back to the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
When did you enlist?
Well, the First World War, after I was in Winnipeg for about a month or so, taking a walk down Main Street, I noticed that the Grenadiers was parading there at the old Industrial Bureau on Main Street, and went down and made application and joined the Winnipeg Grenadiers there. We used to pray once a week and go to camp in the summertime, of course. And from there, well, I stayed with the unit until war broke out in 1914. I joined up as a permanent force to go overseas, and went overseas with what was formed then, the 78th Battalion, which was the Winnipeg Grenadier Battalion. And from there we went overseas, down to Valcartier, stayed in Valcartier until we went overseas as a battalion to, I think it was Kemmel where we landed at, and I was wounded at Vimy Ridge and sent home to England, and was category B3, so I wasn't eligible to go back in the line again, but I was used as a, well, all kinds of things. Drill instructor I was in the camp, you know, training the trainees coming over from Canada. And stayed in England until, I think I came back about June 1919. Arrived in Winnipeg when the strike was on. And
did you have any part in the strike, or you were just a spectator?
No, I was just one of the unfortunate ones that had to walk all the way from Elmwood over to the Spalding School, because I didn't have a bicycle and I didn't have a car. My brother was killed overseas with the CMRs ahead of me, so when I came back from England first, I went and stayed with my brother's wife home in Elmwood.
Yes. Which street did you live on in Illinois?
Harbison, on Harbison Avenue, 281 Harbison Avenue. So I stayed there until, see, I was married and my wife was over in England, and she came back about a month after I did. So we landed back in the Winnipeg. We went and stayed there until we got a home here, like to rent on Downey Street here in Winnipeg.
Okay, now you worked between the two wars at the school board.
That's right. Well, then, you see, once I got settled down, I went back to work and told them I was discharged, and I was ready to go back to work. So I went straight back to the school, to the Spalding School, where I'd quit in 1914. This was 1919, you see. And from there, I stayed on there, working there, up till 1948 was when I went to Sergeant Park School, and I was there 6 years, I guess it was. Well, from 48 to 54, would that be? That's
okay. In more. Okay, the beginning of World War II, mm-hmm. When did you enlist?
Well, I was already in the militia, you see. From the time I came out of the discharge from the First War, I went back to the Grenadiers as what they call then the non-permanent force, you see. And I stayed with them until the war broke out in September the 1st. And I went and re-enlisted and was accepted. And joined with the Grenadiers at Minto Armouries here. From there we went to, well, we was there through several months, then we went to Fort Osborne Barracks.
Mm-hmm. What rank did you have at this time?
Well, being as I was a Sergeant Major in the non-permanent force, I managed to hold my own and stay joined as a CSM. And that rank I held right through until I was discharged.
Okay, now going to Jamaica. What was the trip like and how did you go?
Well, we left Fort Osborne Barracks here and marched down to the train at CPR Depot, and from there we went from there to Vancouver, and from there we went to on the boat, which was called the Awatea. It was an Australian boat, had been used for civilians prior to taking us, and they had one protection, they had one 6-inch gun, I think, placed at the back of it, which we found afterwards, after they used to take gun practice on the way across, you see. Although we were escorted, they still had gun practice on these trailing targets. And every time they fired a round or a shell out of it, it took them about 2 days to anchor it down again, pull it off its morning, you know.
Okay, and your arrival?
Their arrival into Kowloon, mm-hmm. which is on the mainland of China. And after we landed there, we marched down through the streets of Canton, down to what was called then Shampoo Barracks.
And what was the reaction of the Chinese at this time, with all these Canadian troops arriving?
Well, it seemed a funny thing. We were told on the boat that things might be pretty bad time to get there, and we might have to perhaps fight our way off the boat to get onto land. But apparently everything was okay, and we landed. And as far as the Chinese people, as far as I can remember, walking down the street, they, in a way, they seemed surprised, although I guess they were quite used to British troops being around there, you see, even before, it was a permanent station for British troops. Well, they used to serve 3 years, and then go on to India, and then back home. But I don't think they were surprised, although there was a big headlines on the top of the paper, 2,000 Canadian troops arrive in Hong Kong, which we thought was supposed to be a secret, but it wasn't much of a secret when it was headlines in red letters, you know.
And how long was it until the Japanese did attack?
Well, I just forget the date, we left Vancouver on the 25th of October. But the day they did attack actually was Sunday the 8th of December. That was when they first attacked there was rumors that they was going to attack the week before, but nothing happened, and the air force that they had, which was five, were more like seaplanes than anything. They were up in the air and all prepared to meet them coming, but they didn't come. But the following Sunday, they came in full force by the dozens, as it were, and just bombed everything in sight. The airport and the Air Force, they would just demolish the airport as if it was just nothing, and caught the five planes that they had there and put them all out of action. So we had no air support, not whatever, not one.
What were your orders at this time, after the Japanese had attacked?
Well, you see, after the bombing mm-hmm. happened, well, as soon as the bombing did start, of course, there was only, I'd say there was about half of our battalion in camp. The rest were out over in Hong Kong, taking up positions where they were to go if and when it broke out. So we had orders to then, the next day practically, to gather up all equipment possible, and they arranged to get trucks to move all this stuff across the island, which had to be taken across on the ferry boat to get across, you see. Well, that took us, I would say, a good week, because there was so much supplies there that we had in the way of equipment for men and medical equipment. It was said at the time that there was enough supplies there to last us 3 years if it had to be that we stayed there, you see. So this stuff was all moved over by flat lorries, by Chinese mostly, and our own transport, of course. And of course, apparently there hadn't been no time to find warehouses or anywhere to store this stuff, so it was taken up into the hills. Different to, well, Wan Chai Gap was one place where it was, and it was just dumped on the side of the road so they'd get back and get more in case they were, you know, flooded out of there with troops, you see. But it happened that I took about a week before they actually made any attempt to come to the island, you see. Mm-hmm. They were still fighting further down with the British, which was only about, I think it was only about 16 to 20 miles. Even when war broke out, they were still fighting the Chinese then, you know, the Japanese were. But they hadn't declared war, I guess, to a point where we were included, you see.
Now, where did you stay at this time when you took all the supplies over to Hong Kong?
Well, we went in billets in some places. You see, all the civilian folks of Hong Kong, which is way up on the hill, some of them were very... That part of the place was what they called the peak, was the best part of Hong Kong, where the best of civilian people, doctors, lawyers, money men, you know. Well, these people just got up and left the house like it is here, cars in the garage, and everything, and just, I don't know where they went. They must have went down to turn themselves in or try to get away out of it, which some of them did, I think. But anyway, when we first went over there, now, as far as myself, there was a section of us, 10 men and an officer, and we went to one house there up in the peak, and the Chinaman, who used to be the servant, was left in charge. He stayed in charge of the house. He had all the furniture all covered up, and we told him we wanted to, I suppose the officer... officer asked him if we had permission to stay in there, so he cleared out a room and we stayed in there for two or three nights, because there was no actual billet, you see. There was no place, just go where you can. You either had to be outside or wherever you could get in. If it was in the garage, it was in the garage, or any place you could get. So we stayed in there for a couple of nights, and by this time, of course, things were getting worse. So up on, I think it was, yeah, one Shai Gap, and there was billets there, a big house that people had gone and left. So we put quite a few people in there, but where the others went, I don't know from that day to this, but they must have done the same as we, because they were in different parts, or different mountains, you see, different parts, you see, Hong Kong. And we just went to one Shai Gap, and some were in Aberdeen, and some were in Kai Tak. They're all different parts of the different hills on Hong Kong, which there was five, you see. And so that's, and under a commander, and they took their word of command, like, say, from our battalion headquarters, what was in Wan Chai Gat. That was where the colonel and his staff were, you see, and everything, whatever was done from them through runners to the different companies, you see.
Were their headquarters in a private home?
In a private home, yeah. Mm-hmm. And of course there was no lights or anything. We just had oil lamp lights, you know, and blankets over windows, blankets over doors, so they couldn't detect any light when they came over.
And what happened, or what were your orders when the Japanese finally did get close enough within shot range, I guess it would be.
Well, as far as I can make out, was this. I mean, by this time we were all posted out. We were all on the other side of the island. Everything was over as far as we were concerned. Camp was empty. We were all on the other side. And we were allocated to different places and take up different positions. Some men would be out like on night. We'd have like platoons and that in different places, so that some men could go out on guard or on sentry and back in, and others would go out and relieve them. It had to be done that way. See. Although sometimes we went for two or three days, like night and day, where it rained and poured and that, and there was no place to go back.
So, positioned?
Any orders we got was brought to us through a runner from the battalion headquarters to our company commander. But when the Japanese first landed, see, they came across the water in these small boats, and of about, I guess it would hold about 20 or 30 men at the time. Well, the orders came out that there had been a small landing of the so-and-so people, and a certain amount of our troops were sent down with the British down to the waterfront and took up positions down there and were supposed to be trying to keep them away. But apparently, once they got over, well, they seemed to come from by the hundreds from nowhere. Nobody knew actually which way they came in or how they come. Apart from the first initial two or three small boats that landed, you see. But we have often thought that there was an awful lot of Japanese already in Hong Kong. They were ready was as soon as ever a landing was made, that they had uniforms and stuff there and they took part, because the numbers seemed to be, it would almost need a great big boat to bring the numbers that did actually come in there towards the finish, you know.
Where were you positioned when the battle did begin, like the actual fighting that you would do?
Well, we were all stationed in different parts of the island of Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. You see, it went round like this. So some were in Aberdeen, that was almost on another section of the harbour altogether. Mm-hmm. Like we were this side, and they were in Aberdeen. And there was another bunch at what they call Black Links Road. That was a main road that led up the hill. They were all scattered all over everywhere. In fact, I don't believe half of them knew where we were anyway. We were all over the different, you know, we went up to a certain mountain or a position. There was these posts that had been got ready for troops, you see, so they were manned at first. But then, you see, what happened, like as far as where... Now, with Sergeant Major, what's his name?
Osborne.
Where Sergeant Major Osborne was killed, was from this other side, opposite to where we were. We were, say, here, and they were over on the other side. Well, they landed there, but the rumor was then there was only a small amount of them, you see. But apparently, there were so damn many they couldn't even get out of there. They just came right ahead and pushed them right back up the hill to where the other troops were in different places.
And the surrender, how did you find out about this?
Well, now the surrender, as far as that I was concerned, on December the 19th, I was wounded on Mount Cameron. And from there I was taken to Bowen Road Hospital, which is a British military hospital there. And from there on, of course, I was stayed in hospital for several months. So I was not in with those that were capitulated, or surrendered as it were, which were met by different Japanese and searched and rifles and equipment and stuff taken away from them. I never went through that. I was ahead of that by being wounded and going to hospital, you see.
What was the hospital like, and what type of treatment did you get?
Very good hospital, one of the very best. It was a British hospital, manned by British nurses. We had two Canadian nurses there, one here from Winnipeg, Miss Waters from Winnipeg, and Miss Christie from Toronto. That was only two Toronto women nurses we had there. And as luck would have it, they was in Bowen Road Hospital too. There were several hospitals there. There was a naval hospital down on the waterfront, and there were several small hospitals scattered around different islands, you see, different islands, different mountains. They're only small in comparison with Bowen Road. That would hold about 200 or 300 at the least. But one of the very best of hospitals for equipment. It was very, quite up to date in every way. Very good doctors too.
Bowen Road Hospital is on the island of Hong Kong, is it?
Yes, it's up in, I just forget what hill it is. But it's such, you've got one of the hills, a winding road up to this hospital, and it's right facing the sea. You know.
Did you see any change in the hospital during your stay there?
Oh yes, the hospital gradually went downhill as far as that's concerned. When we was there you see, now they bombed the hospital, Bowen Road, the one we were in. but not to any bad degree. It actually caught one corner of the hospital itself, although it was two or three floors of it, besides all the basement stuff, and being right up on the hill. But yes, it did knock one corner, but they managed to patch it up so that it could be used. Mind you, it had the big Red Cross sign flag on the top, but it didn't make any difference. But as far as the hospital concerned itself, it went very good. I mean, we had good treatment and was coming along fine. And as time went on, the Japanese were coming and they were taking all the equipment out of the hospital. They were taking all the medical supplies, and they even took x-ray machines and everything right down to the boat. We could watch them loading these lorries and taking it down to the boat and shipping it to Japan, you see. So that it almost got bad enough that if another person that had been wounded or needed another operation while he was in there, there was no chance of them doing it because the equipment was taken. Now, what happened to all the doctors, I don't know, but they gradually thinned them out. Now, whether they were taken down to a civilian camp, which they might have been, I don't know. But as time went on, it really got bad, because by this time we were getting sick personnel from the camp, the prison camp, you see, down in North Point at that time. It's called North Point. Well, these fellows were living under bugs and lice and everything, but I guess it wasn't a forethought enough to say, well, we put you through a sanitary test or bath and all this, that and the other. But it got to be that some of the wards, the laundry was put out of business because we had no water. See, they put all the water out of commission in Hong Kong, and all the lights. There was no lights anywhere. Of course, the hospital had an emergency as far as light was concerned. But the laundry, there was no, all the mains that led the water into us to feed the hospital and all over Hong Kong too, was just cut right off. There was no water and no light. So there was no laundry, so you can imagine the sheets and things were all changed daily or every other day. Well, they just went, so they give the Chinese job to do this laundry, but it gradually went downhill. I think the hospital, by the time we left there, it was getting almost as crummy in there as it was anywhere else.
And where did you go when you left the camp?
The
hospital, I should
well,
say.
Yes, I went from the hospital, which was after being in Bowen Road for, I would say, 5 months I was in the hospital there. Mm-hmm. The time I went back to North Point camp, that was still on the Hong Kong side. And after we'd been there about a month, they were moved back from there to Kowloon, which was our first place of landing, mm-hmm. barracks, you see.
What was North Point Camp like for the month that you were there? What was the life there like?
Well, there was no really much life, just a bunch of wooden huts. I forget who had been living in there. They'd had some, prior to us going, I think the Indian troops used to stay in there. They were still in peacetime, this was too. The Indian troops used to have that place. It wasn't too bad. The huts were fairly good. They were wooden huts, of course.
What were the meals like?
Well, meals?
Yeah.
Well, your meals consisted of three bowls of rice a day. One for breakfast, one for dinner, one for supper. They did at one time ask them to hold back so many kilos of rice and give us a bread bun, like more of our diet, you know, a bread diet, which they did for a while, but that ran out. They went back to the rice, I don't know why, but we was better off with that than we were without it.
Was there any escape attempts at this time?
Well, from North Point we went back to Sham Shui Po, as I say. Sham Shui Po itself was just ripped. All the window frames were all taken out. The doors were all taken off. Anything the way of woodwork was all been either taken out by, I would imagine, by the Chinese people themselves, or I don't know whether the Japs would want to use it, but anyway, it was all the woodwork was gone. There was nothing but bare brick walls. These huts were brick there, you see. So when we went back to Jamshedpur there, we had to patch up the windows, either brick them up with the mud from the ground, brick them up. There was no cement or anything, of course, but we just bricked them up. And the doors we made, we took sheets of corrugated iron off buildings that had been hit and made doorways with a wooden frame round. I made myself comfortable that way. There were no latrines or nothing. Everything was, plumbing was all taken out, stripped of everything.
What was the life like in this camp now, with everything gone and...
Well, there we had to just settle down the best we could, and we improved our own hut. There were so many men to a hut, and the whole bunch was split up by this time, of course. Mind you, that was a big camp because it held 12,000 troops. That was all the British prisoners or Hong Kong volunteers that had joined up, got a uniform on. They were all taken in there, see? So that took an awful lot of people.
Had the food gotten worse at this camp?
In the camp at first, at one time a day we used to get what they call a soup, like at noon. Well, it wasn't a soup, it was a... over there they grow a lot of daikons, which to us is like a turnip, only it grows more like a parsnip. It has a big top and goes right down to a point. And it can be that long, just like a fiber, you know, goes down. It tastes just like a turnip, and it's white. That was that, and they used to put these sweet potato vines over there. They don't seem to grow the Irish potatoes like we have here. They grow all sweet potatoes, and that adds a vine like a strawberry. You know, it keeps threading itself, seeding itself.
Yeah.
So they used to cut all them vines off where they didn't want and put them in the soup and this stuff. We used to call it green horror. Sometimes there was hardly any vegetables in it at all, but it was green, you know. And the same with the green tea, like we're supposed to have green tea. Well, we didn't see many tea leaves. It was mostly the stalks. It was chopped up and then they threw them in a wooden bucket and poured boiling water into this. That was our tea. But our meals were the same every day, as far as three bowls of rice a day. And from then we started on this work job of moving the mountain from Kowloon there. They started that once we got settled down there. And they used to take us from there down by boat down to this mountain.
How many would go to work each day?
At the beginning on this island, when we first got started, I think pretty well every available man in the whole camp was sent there, with the exception of those that were sick or anything wrong with them, you know. Or there'd be hundreds and hundreds of us go to work. We went down on a boat. They had a boat used to pull in into the dock where we were. And they take us right down to the, as near as they could, to this place, you know. I think it was Kai Tak, close to Kai Tak, what was the airport before, you see, Kai Tak Airport. And it appears that the British had already had this place mapped out, that they were going to remove this mountain. Well, it's quite a height too. It's called a mountain anyway, but the name of it I couldn't tell you. But it's supposed to be a sacred mountain, according to Chinese. And on the center part of this mountain, there was a stone-like image of a certain person in rock, because it wasn't put there, it was natural, but it was termed as a religious mountain, as far as Chinese are concerned. And the British people in the past had been wanting to do it, but didn't want to interfere with their religion part of it, although it was getting to be that it had to be a must to get any different size aeroplanes into there. So the Japanese got a hold of these maps or this diagram of what was going to be done, and bless my soul, if they didn't start into work and pull down buildings pull down big buildings wherever they could and put us to work on this mountain. So we used to go every day. And as I say, there'd be, as far as I know, there'd be at least 500 or 600 on our side of the mountain. It stretched quite a way. Like, it wasn't like a short mountain where, say 50 or 75 or 200 feet or anything like that. It was quite a long way. You couldn't see the other fellows around the other end working, even on your side of it. And then they put about 10,000 Chinese on the other side of the mountain. And they were working just back to front of us, only just the width of it, you see.
And can you describe the work you were doing, or what you did each day?
Well, that was our job for pretty well all the time we were there. We didn't do any other kind of work, only you just go out there and you were detailed off to a certain part of the hill. Mm-hmm.
What did you do with the dirt?
Well, the dirt, as far as we were concerned, was this. They built, we had a miniature railroad there. You could move over all tons, hundreds and hundreds of, I was going to say miles of it. There was an awful lot. And that had to be laid down in different places so far apart, and all this earth that we picked up and put into these trucks and pushed them down the hill, or run them down the hill, and it filled up all the paddy fields that was there. It started from, from water, as the saying is, till it filled up, and then you moved your track over until you could get a good run down from the hill. Sometimes it would be like kind of rock, and sometimes it would be fine stuff. But it was, we was working on that every day in the week, right up to the first draft going away.
How long was the period that you were working there? Was it about a year or two?
Well, years? Until we went to Japan. Mm-hmm. Until we went to Japan. The first bunch, I think they left in June, I think it was. May or June. The first bunch that went. Of course, that lessened the number going to work. Because there was about at least 500 went on the first, what we call the first draft to Japan. And they said, the reason we are sending you to Japan, the food supplies are getting very bad here. You will be fed better there. Oh, they promised all kinds of things, that it would be that much better when you got there, mm-hmm. to work.
So when did you go to Japan? Do you remember what month it was and what year?
In August 42 when I went, yeah.
And what was the trip like, and how did they take you there? Did they take you by boat or by plane?
Yes, well, we left the camp, as I say, with 500 men by boat from Hong Kong. We was on a boat what was sunk in the harbour by the British, which the Japanese had put in dry dock and fixed it up. And we started out, and we got about a day out, a day and a half out, and it started leaking water, and they had to pump and pump until we got to Formosa. So we pulled into Formosa, and we were in Formosa for 10 or 12 days until, well, they worked on this boat to
what
pump the water out.
What did you do in Formosa at this time?
We just stayed right in on the boat. They wouldn't let us off. Down in the hold, too.
Did they give you any exercise at all?
No. We were placed on the boat, 250 up the front. They were worse off than we were. We were in what they call a hold, which holds everything. It was emptied out when we got there, see. And 250 over down the stairway, down in this huge, big, empty space. The other 250 were up the front. I don't know whether that was bigger, never got up there. But there was coal. That's where the coal was, too. Some of them were even laying on coal up in there, half of the set. Alice was just pure, right empty. Just a steep staircase down, and once you're down there, you couldn't get up. So, of course, we wanted a place for latrine. There was a latrine up on the boat, just you come up the stairs, and there's a latrine right there. So, we were allowed to go to the latrine with a Japanese sentry right at the door, all the time, night and day. But you weren't allowed on the deck to see what was going on, or anything else, down the hall. Because it got so hot in Formosa while we were there, that normally, where they have this opening at the top, you see, they had to put the cargo and stuff in an ordinary tank. They took that off, it had a big sheet of tarpaulin on the top of it, and they opened the woodwork. Well, we was open to the sky, that's all, but it was that high up you couldn't see anything out, like either side, only on top, you know, just open there. But it relieved the heat, you know, because it was about 102 or 4 in Formosa at that time. You can imagine the end of August. It's pretty hot over there.
And where did you go when you left
then,
Japan?
After we left Formosa, we went to a place called Osaka. That's where the ship docked, in Osaka. When we got to Osaka, they split the 500 men into two sections. There was my section, the 250, and Sergeant Manchester, he took the other 250. They went to a camp called Nagasaki, and we went to Oyama camp.
And what type of work did you do at Oyama camp? Oyama
camp, it was a nickel mine. And half of the men were working at the factory itself, the smelting plant, and the other half were working out in the hills, digging the ore up and putting it on boxcars, and it was shipped by rail down to the factory, where it went into big huge chutes, you know, down into, and from there into these huge boilers that they had there.
Did you walk to work each day? Was the camp quite close, or how did you get there?
To the factory?
Yeah,
we walked to the factory. The factory would be about a mile and a half from where we were. But the others, they had to go out to where the ore was. They took them out by train and brought them back by train. The same trains as they were loading to bring this stuff in. You see, they bring them back to the factory, so they get a ride out and back. And this, we changed over. We do about 4 or 5 months in the factory, and change over with the other half. They'd come back to the factory. We'd go out on the digging of the stuff, you see.
What was life like in the camp now?
In the camp. Well, you didn't get much time as far as life was concerned. As you went to work in the morning, and you didn't get back till, well, 5 o'clock, I guess, 5:30, something like that would appear. And well, after that, you really had nothing to do as far as that goes.
Was there any group get-togethers, kind of, where they would sing, or?
Well, yes, we used to, for a while there, we had a made-up party of their own. There was quite a few British fellows there amongst themselves, and you see, some of them were already in Hong Kong. They were supposed to go home, the British troops. They were called, there was two regiments with the Royal Scots and the Middlesex. Well, they were due to go back to England, in, as it were, if it hadn't, the war hadn't broke out. They would have gone home in 39. But being as this war was kind of half and half, they held them back. So they didn't get a chance to get home. What they did do, they took all their wives, or given them the privilege to stay in Hong Kong, or go to England, or go to Australia. That was where they had boats. This is just prior to the, apparently just prior to the war breaking out, you see. I guess they figured it was going to happen anyway. So they give these wives and relatives of the soldiers there, of course, that were staying there, the families, chance to, some went to Australia, and that's how we got that same boat. They'd taken a whole bunch of women, wives and that, to Australia, and on their way back to Vancouver, that's how we got that. At the Albertia to bring us over, you see. Otherwise I don't know what boat we'd have. But as far as in the camp, you had to make your own amusement, if anything, you know. We used to sometimes get a guard or a sentry to buy a packet of cards for us or something like that, you know. We'd play cards if we could. And others had a bit of a sing-song sometimes on a Sunday afternoon. it was quite good there for a while, but it gradually deteriorated, you know. As the men got taken away, well, that perhaps took some of the talent away, and it wasn't the same, you know.
Did any of the men manage to sneak any instruments of any kind, like guitars or other band instruments?
Well, there was quite a few, I think. But the fellow named Bob Halpern, he had one of these piano accordions, and he managed to get that back. And I know Johnny Matheson, he went and got a cornet. He used to play cornet in the band, and he had that. Now, whether he was able to keep it or not, I don't know. So, with the odd instrument, it used to be a little bit of a concert sometimes when they got together, you know, and sing all the old songs that we knew and things like that. And the Shamchipu there was before we went to Japan, with a bunch of these Hong Kong people, we had quite a concert party there. Guys even dressed up as women and things like that on the weekend. And the Japs used to just enjoy that, you know.
Let's see. Now, what was the food still about the same at this camp?
Oh, when we got to Japan, the first 2 days we had a feast. Oh, we had a real stew and even some fish and rice for 2 days. Then we went back on to normal, back to the three bowls a day.
was the pay very good, or did you get any
we
pay
didn't
at
get
all?
No, we didn't get any pay.
Let's see. How long were you at this camp, like from the time you got there until the end of the war?
I was at that camp from September. I arrived there on my birthday. September the 5th, we arrived actually from from Osaka into this camp. It took us a day and a half to get there. Well, we stayed overnight in downtown in some place, and we went down a back lane, and they had a whole bunch of so-called cot beds, you know, with the chicken wire on it, and set one above the other into this place to stay there overnight. But as far as the food, it got the same in Japan as it was in Hong Kong, just about the same.
What was the sickness like, or was there any in the camp?
Oh, the sickness was bad. I had a record one time, they took it away, of 28 of our Canadians that had died from dysentery in the camp where I was. That was just grenadiers. So that was a good percentage when you come to figure it out of 250.
Was there any other type of sickness there?
Well, it was mostly either beriberi or dysentery. That was the two main things. You either had one or the other. And by having dysentery, you see, you kept the beriberi away because all the liquid from you was taken away. And apart from that, there was a few men that it didn't bother. They might have had dysentery or something, but got over it. But some got, when they got dysentery, they never got back to normal again. They got so thin. Oh, it's pitiful to see some of them just stand up like a bunch of bones.
Was there any medical treatment at all, or any medicine?
Well, there was. Each camp had, well, our camp, we had one hut called a hospital, which would hold, I guess, about 40 men at the time. And the only one in charge of that was he was a sergeant from the RAMC, the Royal Army Medical Corps, and a corporal belonging to the British troops, which was a RAMC, Royal Army Medical Corps, see? Well, they were the two. They were our doctors, with the exception of a Japanese doctor who would come around once in a while. But apart from that, that was our hospital staff. And the food in the hospital was the same as it was outside. they didn't get any chance to get built up once they got down, you see. And some of them was the biggest thing. Although in a lot of cases it wasn't the worst thing as far as diarrhea is concerned. That would pull anybody down worse than anything. And they don't seem to have any appetite. I mean, who would want you take yourself, anybody feeling sick, and somebody just give you a plate of ordinary rice, but there's nothing on it, you know. There's no sugar or milk or anything. You never saw that all the while we were there. Or salt or anything. At one time we got an issue of, it was like a large envelope with toothpaste in it. It's supposed to be to clean your teeth. Well, they put it on the rice and eat it on the rice. It had a peppermint flavor.
How did you find out that the end of the war was coming?
Well, we got to find out that things were getting better. First of all, we had the news, of course, when Germany had capitulated, and that put a lot of spirit in the camp. Much to say, well, now they've quit, it shouldn't last too much longer. And then we was getting prisoners that were taken on different islands close to us, or much closer than we were when we were captured, of course, on different islands, and they would give us a report of how far the American troops were and what island they were on, and all the different air battles had taken place, and what was sunk and what wasn't, you know. So we had built up hopes from them. And these men that were just caught recently, because they were just like taking any one of us off the street right today, they were in 100% physical shape. They couldn't be better.
How did you finally find out that the war was over?
Well, we was never really told. Not until, as far as I was concerned, the first news that we got really was that we went to work this day like any other day, and we worked up till noon, till we broke for our lunch. We had our lunch and was expecting to be called on to fall in the game like normal. Well, it got from 1 o'clock to 1:30, 2:30. Right up to, I think it was about only up past 3 in the afternoon. We were all sitting around, laying around there, didn't know what to do. We couldn't see no Japanese around. And all of a sudden we see a whole bunch of big shots of the Japanese coming down from the headquarters, their headquarters hut they had there. With the swords dangling on the ground. And then the bosses came over to us and told us to go out and bring all the tools in, pick everything up and bring it in. Didn't say any more. Bring all the stuff in. Well, we could put two and two together. Something had happened, you see. So after we got these tools, at that particular time I was there in charge. I used to be in charge of the tools. It was going out. We got there in the morning. Everything had to be laid out. Shovels and picks and different things the men were going to use. And check them in again every day. So after that was all done, we was marched back to our camp. And the only one thing they did, they raised hell. We were so damn happy that we didn't walk in the gate good enough, so the guard, sentry on the gate, made us walk back to the end of the road again and come in with a high step until we'd done it right, and back again 3 times that day. I don't know whether they were just having the last fling or not. But anyway, they done that. And the next morning, the camp commandant called us up. We used to line up every day to be numbered off and sent me out. Called us up and told us the war was all over and we're all good friends now.
How did the Japanese treat their own men?
Well, they were strict with them. Of course, we didn't have too many to go by. The only Japanese men that we had was a guard that was in our camp. You see, this nickel mine that we worked, I think it was belonging to this private factory. Or it might have been a government factory, but anyway, we were supposed to work for them and they would feed us. That's how it worked out, you see.
Now, when did you first see American planes or get any supplies in?
The first American plane we saw was, we went back to camp that day after putting the tools away, and apparently there was no wood for the cookhouse, so they sent us all out to the hills to saw down trees and bring in the wood to fire the cookhouse up with, you know. And a couple of days before that, we had seen two or three of these, what do you call them now, these bombers of the States. Way, way up, almost just the sun shining on them, glittering. We saw a bit of a dogfight one day. That's the only thing we saw as far as any combat with airplanes, you know. But, of course, after he told us that the war was all over, well, we was wondering what was going to happen next, you see. But about, it wasn't too long. Must have been 2 or 3 days, I think, when we saw this plane overhead and come down and circled around our camp. And it came so down low, I thought it was going to go through the huts, this particular one, you know, and it was so huge when it's so low. And I remember this, he dropped this big drum off at the cookhouse, or above it. It was one of these big oil drums. And in it was a 100-pound sack of sugar, and I think 4 or 5 cans of paint, yellow paint, and brushes. And with a note to say that we would be back very soon with supplies, and please mark number of camp on huts, if possible.
This was on the roof, wasn't it?
On the roof. They were these corrugated roofs, you know. So we had to get up there and paint them. Oh yeah, camp number so-and-so. See. But this drum hit the thing, and the funny part of it, the top came off, and the bag of sugar that was in it, the sack of sugar, it just hit the door on the outside and come halfway in the cookhouse. Somebody said, well, what do you know about that for a shot? He couldn't have raised it any better. And from then on, we used to get these planes come in two or three times a week. First of all, there'd be medical supplies, and all the parachutes were all different colors, blue, red, and white, and stipulated what would be. We got to know that, well, if it's a blue parachute coming down, it would be medical. If it was white, it would be food. If it was another color, it would be clothing. Well, these were all dropped. Of course, they couldn't drop them into our camp where the huts were. So there was like a big field that led down to the wharf where the water used to come, and we used to have to shovel because bring the coal up from there, you see, on these barges. They dropped it all around the field, like it might be a field outside here, you see. And we used to go out and pick all this stuff up and bring it into a big hut that was put there, and we had it all laid out so that all clothing went in one place, all food in another. As it was dropped, it was put together, like say there was a bunch of shoes, well that would be all put in sizes as near as you could. In the meantime, they went round all the huts and asked the fellow what size shoes he took and all this, that and the other. And they would issue it out, starting per hut, you see, until everybody got something. You mostly got shoes and pants and stuff like that. And the Americans are great for windbreakers, you know. So we had these different windbreakers, thin ones, army ones. So everybody was quite satisfied. You got something to wear. It might have been a bit big or a bit tight, but it was near enough to your size, you know. And of course we had food, tins and tins of fruit stored up. Each man, it was all allotted out. If there was 50 come and there was 50 men, you got one apiece. If there was 100 come and 50 men, you got two apiece. Didn't matter what, everything was taken out of the shed and issued as fast as we got it, as long as everybody got the same amount, you know. I always remember there was so much chewing gum come there. And you get these Japanese kids after the war was over, he'd come round to the fence, you know. The guys used to feed them chewing gum. I guess they didn't know anything about spitting it out or anything. They just chew it and swallowed it. But we had that was really a thing, was this first plane that came over. That was the first time We knew everything was okay as far as it was over. We weren't going to get no more trouble. And as far as the Japanese themselves, all the bad ones, what we figured were bad ones that had been tough to us during the camp time, they were all moved out one at a time. Why? We don't know. Now, whether they took them back to put them into service again, you know, being as they'd already been in service, most of these had. Perhaps been fighting against us in Hong Kong, for what I know. But these were the real tough ones. Well, they moved them out. They were the only ones that used to be hard on us in the camp. You know, make us do so many damn different things. Call you out in the middle of the night and number you off. And if you wasn't out there in so many minutes, you'd go back to bed, you'd be back half an hour, and they'd ring it again. But he only done that when the camp commandant was away. That was and he was only the rank of a sergeant, as far as our rating was concerned. And yet he had a whole charge of everything. Didn't matter what he done, it was okay.
Now your trip home, what was this like? And how did you go? Did you go by plane or boat?
Trip home, well, the Americans took us all home, as far as that goes. Well, yes. We left our camp by train and arrived at Yokohama. Now, when we got to Yokohama, it was a sight for sore eyes. They had a great big bang there of about 60 pieces playing roll out the barrel and all this, that, and the other. We were marched down to sheds, long freight sheds, I think they were. We had to take off what clothing we had. Didn't matter if it was brand new or what. As far as they were concerned, I guess it was lousy, you see. So we had to put it on the sidewalk and slip into one hut and got a shower bath there, a face towel and a towel to wash yourself with. Go at the other end, you got your underwear. And then you went around. If they had a pair of army pants to fit you, okay, they had them. If it wasn't, you got a navy pair. Some of us come out of there with army pants and navy hat and half and half or vice versa. We looked at a bunch of everything. But they treated us very good. Very good. I mean, all the way. We had, after we'd had our wash and got clothes on, they gave us a good feed. It was what they call flapjacks and syrup. And from there we were taken posted onto different boats that were in the Hong Kong Harbour. Not the Hong Kong Harbour, what's the name harbour?
Yokohama?
Yeah. There was all kinds of battleships in there of all kinds, British and American. These huge ones too, you know, some of them with the one we were on had what caliber of a thing it was, the gun. The muzzle itself would go 50 feet, 75 feet, I think. And that you could see that had been through the war too, because of all the turrets up on the side of it all been hit by these Japanese divers, you know, bomb and all, where they exploded as they hit. But it was on there. They provided cots and bed for us on, because the weather was good there too. We slept pretty well out in the open, on deck, on these individual cots all lined up on the deck. Well, we stayed there till they were ready to move us out of there, out of Yokohama. And the way we were moved, as far as I'm concerned, these planes that they moved us from Yokohama to Guam, held about 30. And we'd go in bunches of 30 now. Perhaps there may be two planes go today, and some more in another few days. As they came in, they got them moved out, you see. But you didn't know when it was going to be. When we arrived at Guam, well, there was a hospital there. We arrived at a hospital, the big hospital in Guam.
How did they decide who was going to go on what plane? Did they just draw names, or what did they do?
It would appear to me that they just run down a, like, as you arrived, like, they just made, I don't know, it was alphabetical roll, nominal roll, or anything, but it was a list made out. You were called off. Since you cut off at 30, well, the rest stayed, and the next 30 went. That's how they did. Immaterial of rank or anything. just whatever the plane would accommodate, I think 30. And so we arrived into Guam. We stayed there 10 days. By that time, during the 10 days, there was quite a lot of it had come, you see, from different other camps in different days. I suppose according to how many they had room in the hospital. They had lots of room because it's an awful big hospital. So we stayed there 10 days, and then we went from Guam to Honolulu. And we was in Honolulu 10 days, and from there we went by plane to San Francisco. And when we got to San Francisco, we were taken by bus over to a place not too far away where we stayed for 2 or 3 days. 3 days, I think it was. I just forget the name of the camp, but it was a big, there was a lot of Italians in there too. Anyway, we stayed there 3 days, and then we were put on a coach, just the 30 of us, and went from San Francisco way up to Vancouver. We got to Vancouver, and we were put in the Vancouver General, or Shaughnessy Hospital there, until we were fit, as far as they were concerned, or ready to come back to Winnipeg, you see. If he was hospitalized, he was kept there longer. He was up and around, didn't really require any medical treatment. Well, as soon as there was space to go, you could ask to go. And they would come back by train, you see, from there to Winnipeg.
What was the train ride home like from Vancouver?
From Vancouver to Winnipeg?
To Winnipeg, yeah.
Oh, it's just ordinary, as far as the coach is concerned. You know, we had a coach all to ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the men were excited, were they?
Oh, yeah, were they? Oh, it was a good thing. There was lots of fun. And then they had a duck quarter on our train, you know. And I always remember the old dog porter says, "We're stopping at Portland at a certain time, 2 o'clock in the morning. If you want your beer, you better give me your order now." And somehow or another, he went out and got beer. I don't know how the hell he got it. Anyway, you got cases of beer for the guys in Portland.
And what was your arrival in Winnipeg like?
Well, now when I came back to Winnipeg, you see, these fellas was, when we, from Vancouver, do you know where there was only me and another fella left Vancouver to come to Winnipeg?
Just two of you together.
Yeah, the other fella's in California now. Mike Haddad was his name. There was only two, as far as I could understand, they said, "There's room for two on the CPR going to Winnipeg. Who wants to go?" So just us two came on our own as a passenger. They give us tickets, meal tickets and stuff like that to eat on the train, you see. But we didn't come back in any group, right? Just the two of us. That's how they come back in spasm, bits and pieces. The Canadians were so badly scattered. I mean, there's some left in Hong Kong that never come home, never went to Japan at all. Well, they went another way around. They went to Manila and stayed at Manila for a month or so. And then they came from Manila home. Now, whether they come into Vancouver or not, I don't know.
And where did you go when you came into Winnipeg?
Winnipeg?
Did you go to hospital again?
Yes, I had to report it. I had to report to DLH Hospital with my medical papers that gave me at Vancouver Hospital, you see.
And were you detained for any treatment at all in the hospital?
For an examination, yes. It was in there for, I guess, about a week. And I had to go back for treatment. I still had beriberi then. I was still not down as I should be, you know. So I told them what they'd been doing there, you know, the stuff they used to give us. And as far as I was concerned, we, you know, gradually got back to normal. Although I was quite a while getting discharged. We landed back here on Thanksgiving Day that year. I think it was the 8th of October, at that time. And I wasn't discharged actually from the army until April of the next of 53. 48, 52. Well, it was April anyway. So it was in and out of hospital, not good enough to be discharged as yet, and then then we had to have a thorough medical and all that, like to see what had happened while we were there. They took a kind of a, they asked you when we arrived there in Little Mountain in Vancouver, if anything had happened to us over there, was been wounded or what sickness did you have and all this, that and the other. You made a report of that, and I guess they went by that, you see. But actually, I wasn't discharged until, I think it was about April.
Are there any other funny little things that you remember that happened, you know, during the war, either in Jamaica or in Hong Kong or anywhere? Any little trips you used to play?
Well, I haven't got too many. The only one, as I was mentioning, was, as far as we were concerned, we had one thing in Jamaica where they threw us in the swimming pool.
Why was this?
Well, in the sergeant's mess there, it was everybody that had a birthday and it was known, well, they were just dumped into the swimming pool, which was only about 50 yards from where we eat, you see. I remember the day when it was my birthday, I didn't actually know they knew. But anyway, I could feel that they were getting pretty close to me and this, that and the other, so I hung onto the chair I was in. It was a wooden chair. And they carried me across the road and just dumped me right in the pool, chair and all.
Let's see. Do you feel that the Canadian government has treated you fairly since the war?
I do. Myself, I think that they've stood by me pretty good. I've been well looked after when I've been in hospital, and I feel quite satisfied. I compare myself with a lot of people that have been through and perhaps didn't get the same treatment as me. But myself, I feel quite satisfied.